You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. When the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Trump administration's Muslim ban, authors of both the opinion and the dissent referred back to a decision from more than 70 years prior. It's a decision that today is considered a stain on the conscience of the court. It was the decision in Korematsu versus the United States, which legalized the Roosevelt government's decision to round up and imprison some 120,000 people solely on the basis of their ancestry. It was World War II. They were Japanese American. And in short order, most found themselves moved from vibrant communities and coastal metropolises to desolate camps in the interior. Now, a lot of us only know what happened thanks to years of work by activists and historians to uncover the story. And what we do know is focused almost entirely on how people were forced into the camps and what happened to them once they got there. There's been very little work on what happened after they were let out, on how long it takes a people to put their lives back together after they've been demonized, dispossessed, and oppressed. Our next guest set out to fix that hole in the record. Naomi Hirahara is author of Life After Manzanar, just out from Heyday Press. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Why don't you start by kind of setting the table for us? This is all about the people who were sent to the first internment camp in the Owens Valley, Manzanar. Describe the place. Describe who was sent there.
So at its peak, Manzanar held 10,000 Japanese Americans, and it's right in the Owens Valley. The beautiful Sierra Nevadas are above them. So it's a place of contradictions. It's very haunting. I went there recently for the annual pilgrimage in April, and this wind just rushes in. Like when I'm driving, I feel like my car might even turn over to its side. And I was just imagining people when they arrived, you know, dealing with those kind of weather conditions. They're living in these barracks made out of wood with tar paper. And of course, that kind of dust is going to get into all of their, you know, clothing. At first, they were sleeping in mattress filled with straw. There was no walls separating them from other families, so it was just blankets. So it was a very stark situation, and people did not know how long they would be there for.
It's an incredibly desolate place, extremely cold in the winter, extremely hot in the summer. The wind you described almost never stops there.
Yes, and another thing is that it really disrupted the whole flow of a family. There were like mess halls, you know, you didn't have private kitchens. You know, families are kind of separated when they're eating. There's a latrine. The Manzanar National Historic Site, who is the one partially responsible for initiating this book, the other's Heyday Press, a nonprofit publisher here in Berkeley. They have been recreating a lot of things at Manzanar. It's really amazing. There's mess hall and there's gardens that are being restored. And another thing is a latrine. And they have a woman's latrine. You walk in and there's just like, you know, very close vicinity to a line of other toilets, no walls like separating them. So you could just imagine, you know, for a family that's very much into privacy, especially going to the restroom, suddenly, you know, being subjected to something like that was very humiliating.
And all of this ringed by barbed wire and guard towers.
Yes.
Like a prisoner of war camp. Only with families and
yes,
children inside.
Yes, yes, yes. In the very beginning of preserving that site, people were saying, oh, these guards were protecting the Japanese, you know. But then people were saying, well, why were the guns, you know, facing inward and not outward?
So where were the people who were imprisoned in Manzanar coming from?
Actually, one third came from Southern California. Los Angeles was a big area. But, you know, one of the first groups came all the way from a very idyllic island, Bainbridge Island, close to Seattle. And they were one of the first people to be forcibly removed. A Terminal Island, which was down in Southern California, those individuals had to leave in February, and they went into, quote, the mainland, and then had to move again. But in case of Bainbridge Island, they were sent straight to Manzanar.
The largest population of Japanese Americans was in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles. It's a community that had strong institutions, businesses, strong social bonds. Well, what happened to those things when people were transplanted into the Owens Valley?
So Little Tokyo for a short time was like a ghost town. Just imagine how empty it was with all the residents and business owners gone. And then there were blacks from the Deep South that had come to Southern California to work in the defense industry, but they faced racial covenants. They were discriminated from housing because of the color of their skin. So city officials were scrambling, and they're going, oh, there's this open area in, you know, the center of LA, Little Tokyo, why don't you live there? And so this area became very overcrowded. And its name even changed from Little Tokyo to Bronzeville temporarily. People were working, you know, day and night. There were jazz clubs. So there was a lot of kind of cultural activity. There was African-American newspaper that was active. And they were very actually sympathetic to the plight of Japanese-Americans. They, in fact, said that they would no longer use the racial epithet Japs in their stories.
This is the newspaper, the California Eagle?
Yes. So they were, you know, in spite of the fact that they were able to have a place to live because of this removal, they nonetheless understood, like, the bigger story that was happening.
Okay. So I think we've got to kind of gotten to the point of departure for your book, which is you have these camps. Manzanar is peaking at a population of 10,000. And then at some point, the United States government starts letting people leave. But they're leaving in the context of an immense wartime propaganda effort that has, in part, completely dehumanized the Japanese people to the American public. And also having had the communities that they came from just be kind of dismantled in the way you described. So who were the first people out of the camp?
Among the early ones were actually the Nisei, the second generation. They were the ones who were very promising or were thinking of going to college. There was some resettler groups. There was a lot of effort behind the Quakers and the American Friends Service Committee. They worked in conjunction with the government to look for alternatives for these Japanese Americans. The War Relocation Authority, however, always warned these young people, don't bunch up in groups. You shouldn't be in groups of three or more, you know. So there was definitely this sediment of trying to kind of erase or totally, quote, assimilate Japanese Americans into the mainstream. And of course, this movement was in the interior of the U.S. Like this one woman, Momo Nagano, she went to Wheaton. This particular college was all women's in Massachusetts. And when she arrived in the middle of the night, her whole dorm had stayed up to see her because they had never seen a Japanese American before. And that was the case for the whole town. So some Nisei were kind of entering those kind of communities. As, you know, a lot of young men, they wanted to get out as soon as possible. One of the more popular outposts was Chicago because it was in the interior, there was work.
And the reason it's significant that it was in the interior is because they were still forbidden from living free within 1,000 miles of the Pacific
Coast.
Yeah,
that was because they could not go into that military zone. So that's why in our particular book, we were seeing this movement, this diaspora to places like Chicago, to New Jersey, where there was Seabrook Farms connected with frozen food, manufacturing and packaging. People going to Detroit, going to Denver, so really spreading out to all these places. However, ironically, in spite of the government saying don't bunch up, if you're going to a place like Chicago from California, you don't know anybody, there's not much housing available, Chicago became a community from 400 Japanese Americans before World War II to 20,000 Japanese Americans. And they all primarily lived in two neighborhoods, either the South Side or this area in the north, the intersection of Clark and Division. So much for don't bunch up. People, you know, like, who are you going to trust? You're taken away from your homes, you're in camps, and you're in a new place. Of course, you're going to try to be with other, you know, Japanese American families that you know.
And so these are people who've been through a double uprooting, when they're taken from their homes along the West Coast and put into Manzanar, and then when they're let out of Manzanar but not allowed to go home.
Right. And in some cases, it might have been a triple or quadruple uprooting.
Sure.
Yeah. And there was a lot of hopscotching, because people would go to Wisconsin. It was beautiful, but there's no work, so they would have to go to Chicago. So people, you know, were trying out different geographies and moving on.
So you alluded to this earlier with your anecdote about a young woman showing up in a dorm where everybody stayed awake to see their first Japanese person. What was it like leaving Manzanar and reentering an American society that had been saturated with anti-Japanese wartime propaganda?
It was a mixed experience for some people. I'll take Chicago, for example. There was a woman from Los Angeles who later became a great political leader. She became in charge of the Manzanar pilgrimage and really worked to make Manzanar a National Historic Site. Her name was Sue Embry. She came from Los Angeles. She's in Manzanar, and then moved from Wisconsin to Chicago. And she worked at a beautiful reference library in Newberry, and suddenly was working in an integrated area with alongside blacks and whites. And she found it very stimulating. She worked across the street from a park that called Bug House. Its proper name was Washington Square Park, I believe, but they nicknamed it Bug House Square because, quote, political weirdos would be on a soapbox and shouting things to people. But I've always wondered if that helped politicize her, Sue, in any way. So in her case, it was positive. Going to Chicago was a huge adjustment. There are a lot of young people who are unsupervised, you know, and of course, a place like Chicago is known for gambling and those kind of things. There were certain plant managers who had lost maybe a son in the war and were very resistant about hiring any Japanese Americans. That lessened over time, but there certainly was that sentiment. But there were cases of young people really getting into trouble. There was babies born out of wedlock. There was cases of abortion. There was apparently a stick-up guy in the community. And there was even a sexual predator in the community. So it really kind of illustrates the kind of effects of people. Of course, you know, if you're going to be released from a camp suddenly into this, quote, area of freedom, but then you find a lot of resistance from the community, there's going to be cases where people are going to act out.
What about when the war was winding down and people were allowed back to the West Coast?
It's interesting. In doing our research, we found a report. It was actually called like acts of terrorism toward Japanese Americans. So there were cases of like Carnation Farm being set on fire. There were people shooting off guns at Japanese American homes. They put people in camp, and now the authorities were trying to transition them back in. So this was a huge obstacle. So they did send like photographers, the War Relocation Authority. It was very ironic, you know, first they're cast as villains and now they're cast as good citizens that are working at a pharmacy and things like that. So there was definitely a concerted PR campaign.
Meaning the government knew it had created a problem.
Right, exactly, exactly. And then what do you do with the poorest of the poor Japanese? There were some people who were able to retain their homes because of good neighbors who took care of them. But there were people who lost their businesses or never had, you know, a home to call their own. They're given a one-way bus ticket and $25 by the government. You know, good luck. So there was actually trailer parks and temporary, like, military installations that would turn into housing. There were hostels that Japanese Americans lived in, especially in Los Angeles, in terms of the people from Manzanar. And in terms of the trailers, there were conditions very much like what they faced when they first entered Manzanar. They didn't have a kitchen. It was a communal kitchen, and they had to share bathrooms with other families. And for some families, it wasn't just like a 2 or 3 month thing. For some, it could be a couple years that they were living in those kind of situations.
One of the most heartbreaking stories in your book, Life After Manzanar, is about orphans who were held in the camp. And there wasn't really anybody to take care of them upon release. It's eerily reminiscent of what we're hearing about some of the children who've been separated from their families at the border today.
My co-writer, C. Lindquist, and I were saying, yeah, it is very eerie and very heartbreaking. Well, I guess there is a difference in the sense that they didn't have their families to begin with. I mean, they were in orphanages in Los Angeles and San Francisco and other places. The Manzanar had the only orphanage out of all the 10 camps. So there were over 100 children there. And while they were there, actually, they kind of built a community among themselves. So even though they weren't a blood sister or blood brother, they kind of, you know, bonded to that extent. And so those children were adopted or by either people in camp or out of camp. But of course, some weren't. So they had to enter the foster system. And again, it was a mixed experience for some people. For some people, they, you know, taken care of by the right person. And in other cases, they weren't the right person. So it was very tough for them.
I'm curious, like, what your sense is of how the process of being placed into these camps changed the people who went through it, how they were changed when they came out.
Became a interesting theme of the book was actually the post-traumatic stress that people faced. For instance, Ellen Nishio was one of our subjects. He's also a friend, but he was born in August 1945, so he was one of the last babies to actually be born in Manzanar. He did not even know that he was born in a concentration camp until he was a student at Berkeley in the 60s. In other words, his parents had never talked to him about it. He thought he was born in a labor camp, you know, regular labor camp in the Owens Valley. And I think that that is something that we hear a lot, that from people who are either children or grandchildren of people who were in Manzanar, that there was a lot of silence.
Silence? Why? Because the experience was a source of shame or because it was too painful?
I think for both reasons. I think one, there was maybe a collective shame because why would your own government put you in a camp? And in the case of the Issei, the first generation, they could not become naturalized citizens even if they wanted to. That option was off the table, which was not the case if you were a Yugoslav immigrant. You could be an immigrant before World War II. So I think, you know, there was that shame. And I think also there was pain, but also they had to somehow survive. You know, if you lost everything, you got to figure out a way, well, how am I going to, you know, support my family? And for many of them, you know, 1 out of 10 men became gardeners because all you needed was a pickup truck that and a push mower and you were in business. So these were people who maybe had a thriving grocery store at one time, who, you know, who had a good job before World War II and suddenly had to, you know, do straight manual labor, you know, at an older age. Maybe you're 50 years old and doing this kind of work. So I think a combination of those kind of things. So finally, when people started talking about it, in relation to the redress and reparation movements, the commission hearings in the 1980s, you know, there's a stereotype that Japanese American older men are stoic, but suddenly they're seeing their patriarchs, you know, their fathers, their uncles, like just like break down in tears as they're describing what had happened to them. So it's just like all of these things had been kind of repressed over this time, and suddenly they had permission to speak. You know, we definitely saw this kind of trauma that was kind of passed on to their children and grandchildren. They might not even describe it as trauma themselves, but the fact that there's these real gaps in their own personal history that weren't passed down, I mean, it has to mean something.
Do you think it was more than the PTSD? Was there a sincere and justified fear that speaking up about what happened might trigger repercussions?
I think there was just so much uncertainty at that time. You know, there was a lot of conflict even among the community. There were some individuals that felt that community institutions had sold them out, had maybe informed on them. So, you know, there were, even within the community, there was suspicion. So, like, who could you trust? For instance, a lot of the leaders were picked up on December 7th, 1941. Why was I picked up? You know, who told the authorities about me? You know, so I'm sure those kind of things are in back of people's minds. It could be that, you know, there's no way to process it. And it's interesting when we saw the oral histories of people who were children at camp, like one leader of the Japanese American Citizens League, John Tateishi, he described, like, he thought, like, within the barbed wire was Manzanar, and outside of the barbed wire was America, you know. So America was not within the camp, which is really interesting. But he also described when he would talk to his friends about men, you know, they would always have these superficial kind of conversations about camp, the weather and things like that. But it would always stop at a certain place. You know, people would always often ask, like, what camp were you in? You know, and there would be camaraderie with that. But it would never go too deep into, like, asking, well, why did this really happen? The conversation stopped at a certain point, because I think everyone knew you don't want to go there.
Yeah. And there were these divisions in the Japanese American community. Was the best response to work with U.S. authorities and try to be a model and get on their good side? Was it to persist? Fred Korematsu, who took the issue of internment all the way to the Supreme Court, that decision was not a particularly popular one within the Japanese American community.
Yeah, and we also followed those kind of decisions that people made. I mean, we do say, you know, like in Manzanar, there's, well, cumulatively, there were 11,000 people, and so there's going to be 11,000 different stories, right? And in the case, I think if you looked at military service versus court dissidents, it really shows you the great division and the difference in the direction that people chose to go. One of the families that we looked at was the Wakayama family. The patriarch Ernest, who was an immigrant, he actually fought in World War I for the U.S., but he was very angered about the incarceration of Japanese Americans. He even filed a habeas corpus. He was a San Anita Assembly Center. And then the family was sent to Manzanar, and he decided, like, he could not stay in America, and they eventually decided to go to Japan. His own son, Edgar, was born in Manzanar, and they were in Japan, but then Edgar decided he would go back to America, and this is around the Vietnam War era, and his father encouraged him to enlist in the military at that time. So there's a bunch of interesting contradictions.
Yeah, when you talk about choosing to go to Japan, we should untangle what that meant at the time.
Sure, and it's interesting that we talk about this quote, choosing to go to Japan, because it's tied into Tule Lake War Relocation Center became a segregation center. It was during World War II, and they are having a pilgrimage, actually, this weekend, and it was tied to the loyalty oath that the government imposed on the people. And there were these two particular questions that were very confusing to people. They kind of put the Issei, the first generation, in a position where they would have to renounce their Japanese citizenship. But then if they did that and they couldn't become American citizens, what are their alternatives they have?
It was literally a question like, will you renounce all loyalty to the Emperor of Japan?
Exactly, yeah.
And which people might answer no if they felt they had no loyalty to the Emperor of Japan in the first place.
Exactly.
They also might answer no out of concern that they would become stateless because they couldn't become citizens
right,
of the U.S.
Right. So it's a no-win, you know, kind of situation. And the other one, you know, would you fight for the U.S. Army, military, and people there, some people felt, well, if you let us out of camp, we will. That particular group of people, the draft resistors, they mostly came out of Heart Mountain War Relocation Center. And they actually resisted the draft and they were sent to prison in Leavenworth. So it's so fascinating to see all these different ways that people responded. So if you said on those two questions, no, no, then you were sent to Tule Lake. And in within that segregation center, some people decided that they would return to Japan. And in some cases, their children who are minors, who are American citizens, were forced to go to Japan as well. And for some families, they would arrive and they would find, you know, the whole country in shambles. Some people had links to Hiroshima, you know, and it was totally decimated. And they themselves had difficulty transitioning to Japan because they weren't Japanese, you know. Even if they were, had been born there, they essentially had become Americans. So it was a hard life.
I wanted to talk for a minute about the process that it took to reopen the conversation about what happened in Manzanar. The movement to reopen this chapter of American history starts with the pilgrimage you referenced several times, the pilgrimage to Manzanar. When did that begin?
There were a lot of private or smaller pilgrimages, like right immediately after, and it was really to honor those who had died and been buried in the cemetery. So a Buddhist minister linked to a Buddhist church in Gardena, California. You know, in the beginning, they brought, you know, a busload of people over there to, you know, clean the gravestones and do those kind of things. And over time, less and less people did it. But in the 1960s, there was a group from UCLA, young people, and it was in conjunction with the whole civil rights movement, the Black Power movement. Japanese Americans and actually Asian Americans were kind of relooking at the incarceration and trying to understand it, trying to recognize like this was a pivotal point in their own ethnic history. And so they went on a December in the 1960s. And from there, it just became an annual event. Some people call a place like Manzanar kind of a site of conscience. So it's not only to recognize the people who were there, but also to remember just to the stripping away of the constitutional rights of a group of people, a group of Americans, and kind of liking it to draw parallels between what had happened then and what is happening in our country today.
When that generation of college students restarted the pilgrimage to Manzanar, the internment camp had basically been razed to the ground. It was like history had been erased there. There wasn't much of a trace of what their parents had been through.
Yeah. I mean, other camps like Heart Mountain, there were actually homesteaders that bought some of the barracks and lived in it. But in the case of Manzanar, everything was pretty much dismantled. Ironically, it was on like water and power land, so it has a connection to Los Angeles.
Because it's in the Mono Lake watershed.
Exactly. So, but there were a few things. There was some structures that a stone mason expert, Ryoro Kado, had created, and as well as the marker. They call it the soul consoling tower that marks the cemetery. I think it's just the eeriness of the emptiness that can really affect people as well, and just recalling, you know, the 10,000 who were there. Of course, now there's a lot more structures, and the way it affects me today, because when people hear of, oh, they had gardens in Manzanar, oh, they played basketball in Manzanar, like, oh, these people were having a good time kind of thing. But actually to see the efforts rebuilt, it's very poignant. It makes me feel and think about the Issei, the first generation leaders, that somehow within their power, they were trying to create an environment that would be better for their children and grandchildren. They were essentially trying to put some green in there, put some water in there, create some activities within the camp. And when I go there today and see those recreations, it affects me emotionally in a different way. I'm moved by the fact that in spite of their situation, in spite of being behind barbed wire, there was this effort to, I guess you could even call it to resist or to reclaim their lives in some way.
If you don't mind my asking, what's your family story during that period?
It's kind of interesting. I'm a slight kind of outsider to the story because my parents were actually in Hiroshima during World War II. So that's a whole nother story. But my extended family, they were in camps in Arkansas. And they lived in this beautiful Victorian house in Watsonville, California, in the middle of lettuce fields. And they lost their home. But when they returned back to Watsonville, they were able to hire a lawyer and get it back. So when my father returned to California, he was actually even able to live in that house and engage in strawberry tenant farming and things like that before he eventually made his way down to Los Angeles and became a gardener. And my professional background is I worked at the largest Japanese-American newspaper in the U.S. It's called the Rafu Shimpo, and it still exists, surprisingly enough. I worked there in the 80s and the 90s, two separate times, but it was during the era where we were fighting for redress and reparations, as well as the distribution of the reparations money. So we were covering all these kind of stories. So it was a very kind of exciting time. It was a time where kind of our democratic system worked.
It was the Reagan years.
I know.
It was 1988 that the government officially apologized and cut $20,000 checks to everyone who was still alive who'd been in those camps.
So, I mean, working on this book and just seeing how just watching the political movement of like redress reparations, and it took a very, very long time. It was not easy. And people who were on different sides of the aisle had to work together. It has made me think that in terms of progress in our society, it's not going to just be from one president, and it cannot necessarily be stymied by one president either, that there's a lot of factors that we don't know that are going to come together and spark something else. So I have come to think that, it has to, real change, I do think has to be more grassroots, from the people, from the bottom down. And it's very frustrating and it's tough. And there's going to be so much conflict among people to do this because it's not easy. But I think that's one big lesson, I think, from life after Manzanar that definitely is connected to what is happening in our country today.
Well, it's a hopeful note to end on. Naomi Hirahara, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Naomi Hirahara is co-author with Heather Lindquist of the new book, Life After Manzanar. It's just out from Heyday Press.